Here we are on Zoom, first time, for our second or penultimate session of the academic year, and an opportunity to learn from Laura Huang about her incredible research and her recent book, Edge, Turning Adversity into Advantage. Many of you have had the pleasure of meeting Laura. She's been at HBS since 2018 as the MBA class of 1954 Associate Professor of Business Administration in the Organization Behavior Unit. And her research interests are really fascinating because she's been studying these subtle signals and cues that often impact perceptions of investors. And so leading to like how do people choose who to invest in? And how do we make sure that our voices are heard and that our advantage is put forward? And, you know, I must admit it is very surreal sitting in front of my computer screen, especially with the Stamps Reading Room background, when I know this isn't where I really am, but my heart is really there. Usually I like to be standing outside the Aldridge classroom door and welcoming you. So this seems very odd, but on the other hand, it's enabling us to get together in a way that we wouldn't have been able to otherwise. So Laura, we'll dive in, and Laura's asked us to try to be as interactive as possible. She's going to talk us through some portions of the book, some things that resonate with her, especially with everything that's going on with the pandemic, and then we'll just open it up to questions. But just one norm is it would be helpful to you, to all of us, if you could type out your questions so that we have them running in chat as well. And then when we get to a point when you have, you know, you want to make a comment or ask a question, just raise your hand and then we'll turn the mic over to you. So Laura, thank you so much for joining us. We're looking forward to hearing about how to get an edge.
Thanks, Sam. Hello, everybody. Hello, hello, hello. Thank you to all of you who have your videos on. I love seeing faces here instead of seeing, you know, boxes with names. So everyone who, you know, as many as you who are willing to, please turn your videos on. I would love this to be really interactive, even though we're sort of in this very, very surreal environment. I see some of my students out there. I see some alumni. I see some colleagues. It's so amazing to be able to do this. So thank you for experimenting with us on this. I was telling a friend of mine today, I was saying, well, you know, I get to be the first to give a book talk over Zoom. So, you know, there are silver linings to this. The book that I wrote that was released January 28th is called Edge, Turning Adversity into Advantage. And when I wrote this book, I was not thinking about adversity admittedly in this way. I was not thinking about all of the different sort of nuances that we would be dealing with in this current environment. And, you know, in some ways, I almost feel like the book should have been titled Turning Your Adversity into Your Advantage, because what I've sort of realized is that this sort of pandemic, this virus, these circumstances that we're in right now, it's really impacting people so differently. And one of the things that I talk a lot about in my book is that this is really something that's personal. When you think about adversity, there are broad sort of things that we think about. You know, there is adversity based on someone's race or gender or class or circumstances, but there's so many nuances involved and there's so many different ways that people have to handle it. And one of the things that I'm sort of realizing is that we all sort of had our own routines, our own ways of going about the day, our own ways of dealing with something like this. And so it also, the solution also needs to be something really individual as well. The book I wrote was really about how some people naturally have an advantage in life and others have to sort of create one for themselves. And it's based on this sort of notion that we're taught from a really young age that success is about hard work, right? You ask super successful people, you ask leaders, you ask our graduates, you ask people who have won Olympic medals, What was the secret to your success? And inevitably, people will mention hard work. It'll be one of those things that they mention. And we recently, I think in the last, you know, couple of years, we've had this love affair with hard work and grit. And if you put in that hard work, the accomplishments and the outcomes and the rewards will come to you. But in the back of our minds, we also sort of know that even though hard work is critical, hard work alone isn't enough. That there is definitely this dimension to, we put in the hard work and hard work leaves us frustrated. And that's because so much of the outcomes and success in our lives are due to things like signals and perceptions and the stereotypes of others. And so this book was really about how we can flip the stereotypes and obstacles in our favor so that we can find and create our own edge. And I think, you know, as I sort of think about the journey that even sort of our own, the things that we're faced with now, you know, it's really about doing the same things over and over and over again and hitting the same walls over and over and over again. And I think even now, it's one of the frustrations we have is that we came into this with a lot of momentum. Like all of us were sort of going along with the momentum that we had been expecting. And then it was like we flipped the switch and we're still expected to do all of the things that we were doing before in the same ways, to the same extent, in the same, and yet we're not quite able to sort of step back and say, you know, we can't be doing the same things in the same ways, with the same routines, using the same sort of tools, that we need to be able to sort of think about things in different ways. You know, there was an entrepreneur that I was just talking to the other day that was saying, last month I brought in $15,000 in revenue, and so far this month I've brought in zero. And it can't be sort of a, how do I go back to bringing in $15,000 in revenue like I was doing before? It needs to be starting from this new slate, this new reality, this new normal. How do I now sort of tackle those sorts of things? And I think those are sort of some of the things that I talk about in the book, albeit not towards coronavirus itself, but it's how do we empower ourselves to use the tools that we have to create our own edge. And so the book is about, even though it's about how do you gain an edge, it's based on this framework that I've developed through more than a decade of my research, where the EDGE, the edge, actually stands for the components of this framework. The E is for enrich. It's about how do you enrich and provide value in any sort of context that you're in. It's about how do you think about your abilities and your strengths and your underestimated strengths and weaknesses, and how do you take those to really provide value in any sort of context that you're in. The D is the light, because a lot of times before we even have the opportunity to enrich, we realize that we're either not given that opportunity because we don't belong to the right networks or the right groups, or because we look a certain way, or we, for whatever reason, don't have that chance. And so when you're able to delight someone, that's the equivalent of being able to crack that door open so that you get that opportunity to show how you enrich and provide value. The G is for guide. Because even when we enrich and know how we enrich and are able to delight others, we need to be able to guide the perceptions of others. We need to be able to redirect them to who we authentically are and guide sort of that narrative around who we are and the trajectory that we have. And that final E stands for effort and hard work. We often think that effort and hard work comes first, that if you put in the hard work, that the rewards will come to you, that hard work will speak for itself. But in fact, hard work comes last, because when you know how you enrich and delight and guide, that's when your hard work works harder for you. That's when you're able to sort of take those headwinds and those tailwinds, and your hard work becomes hard work plus. That hard work works harder for you. And so in our current environment, in terms of facing this sort of adversity, whatever form it comes in, however it's impacting us, however it's impacting us differently, one of the important things is being able to go back to thinking about how we enrich, going back to our basic goods, going back to what are those three or four core things that really make us who we are, and understanding then how we use that to see and act upon these new opportunities to delight, how we can hone our ability to see how this affects us and enables us specifically to continue to guide these sort of perceptions in this sort of new reality that we're in. So I want to sort of stop there, because I don't want to make this a true book talk in the sense that, you know, I'm presenting slides and I'm sort of giving a 30-minute keynote, but more sort of having this be this interactive way that we sort of approach this. So I would love to sort of hear what thoughts you have on what I've sort of said so far, any reflections you have, and make this very conversational, and sort of questions or reflections that you have at this point that I would be happy to sort of then in turn give my thoughts on. So anyone who has any reflections, please feel free to either raise your hand using the hand raise feature or type in your comments to us here. And I'll just pause for a second to allow us to kind of do that.
It's not usually a shy bunch.
You know, I think this sort of goes to, I do see a hand, and I'm just going to give a quick kind of comment, and then we'll get to Kendall and Nicole. But, you know, one of the reflections that I've had sort of in this environment also is that, you know, when I write about, in a lot of my research, it's about these nuances. It's about these perceptions that we have. It's about the fact that you can walk into a room and based on, you know, change one variable, and everything sort of changes, right? You change the industry that you're in, or you change the mix of people that you're with, or you change the sort of time of day or the context, and everything sort of changes, which is why it's so important to really be able to hone your gut feel around how you're being perceived and your interactions with other people. And, you know, this dynamic that we're in makes that even more apparent, right? To some extent, we are losing a lot of signals that we were ordinarily getting, right? Body language, the way in which somebody walks across the room, the way in which they approach you and introduce themselves to you. But at the same time, I think we're becoming much more apparent. We're focused a lot more on facial expressions, which we're focused a lot more on sort of other different dynamics and different ways in which we have to interact. And I think that's something really important as we sort of acknowledge this. One of the things that I do a lot of research on is uncertainty. How do we make decisions under conditions of uncertainty? And what makes it especially complex now is that normally under conditions of uncertainty, we do things like try and put together contingency plans, measure the risk, try and make decisions under probabilistic outcomes. Here we just don't have a lot of that. We are under extreme risk in the sense that we don't know if this is going to last for a month or if this is going to last for a year. We also do things when we're under conditions of uncertainty, like we follow others. Right? We do what others are doing. We use others as sources of information. But in this situation, you know, that's not necessarily the best thing either. And so what a lot of my research has looked at in the past couple of years is, in what instances do we want to be relying on data? In what instances do we want to be relying on our gut feel and our intuition? And how do we know the difference? Because there are situations in which we do want to rely on our mental models and our schemas and our intuition and sort of chuck out the analytical information. But in other instances, it's the complete opposite. So this makes it particularly challenging to really gain our edge, because we're dealing with this sort of contextual reality as well as the new reality that we ourselves are placed in, under. Okay, so I've now talked sufficiently long for there to be lots of hand raises and lots of sort of comments. So let's start with Kendall. Kendall, would you please Is Kendall in video? I don't know if she is, but would you? Oh, I see. Okay. So would you please, any reflections or questions that you might have?
Yes, I think mine, I'm looking through the chat, and I think it relates a bit to...
No, don't copy those. Well. Don't copy those from the chat, because you did it first.
So no, I think there's overlap with Caroline's. But my question was how, basically looking back at your own research and your path to even decide to enter the field and pursue this career, how have you seen kind of the EDGE framework play out, both in your own decision-making, how has it led you to where you are today? And those different components you were describing, how do you, what are perhaps examples of those in your research work?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's, you know, I started out by studying, you know, I've been studying inequality and disadvantage and people who are underestimated for quite a long time. And one of the reasons why I started studying this in the first place was because before I even went into academia, I remember as a child that I was growing up and my parents, I would see them getting passed over for promotion after promotion after promotion, both my mother and my father. And I remember that in one particular instance, my dad had gotten passed over for this promotion that he really, really wanted and that he really, really thought that he sort of deserved, and he had put in a lot of hard work. And when he was denied sort of that promotion, I asked him, I said, well, why do you think it was that you didn't get this promotion? And this was at a point where he was doing the job of his boss who had gotten promoted over him. So the person who had gotten promoted over him was actually not qualified to do it. But was doing this job. And so I said, why do you think it was that you didn't get this? And he said, I don't know, you know, it's probably because of my accent or because of the way I communicate, or something along those lines. And so I, you know, when I went into academia, one of the very first things that I started studying was accent. I ran a series of studies where I wanted to find out were there differences based on someone's accent. And I found through multiple studies that people were less likely to get promoted. They were less likely to get hired for top management team positions. They were less likely to get funding, all sorts of sort of negative outcomes based on their accent. I tested whether it was because of communication. And, you know, I would randomly assign people who had Native American accents and non-Native American accents to different conditions, and would do things, for example, where I'd have investors not rate whether or not they would invest, but give me three bullet points of what you remember from this person's pitch, or what are three things that you learned from this person's presentation. And what I found was that there was no difference. In fact, those who had an accent were actually able to communicate more in some instances, and investors were able to learn more from those who had accents than otherwise. And so I was like, okay, if it's not about communication, what is it about? And found that there's always these underlying perceptions that we know we can't discriminate against people for things like accent, for example. But we can agree, like, okay, we're gonna hire someone that can think outside the box, that is a good team player, that is interpersonally influential. And it just so happened that those sort of characteristics were what people with accents were rated the lowest based on. That there were these underlying perceptions. And so what I then did was, you know, and sort of the impetus for this book was I kept finding these negative sort of outcomes based on not just accent, but things like gender and race and class and age and ethnicity and, you know, religion, sexual orientation, all sorts of things. And I kept getting asked the question, well, what do we do about this? Are there ways that we can then level the playing field? And so what I've been doing the last couple of years is trying to find ways to inoculate against these sort of things. How do we flip things in our favor? When we know that there's stereotypes, how do we flip those stereotypes around so that they work as an advantage rather than as a negative? And so when I recognized that there were underlying perceptions that people with accent, for example, were getting rated much lower on things like interpersonal influence or being a team player, what I then did was I would have those individuals go into interview situations. And before they did, I would say to them, the perception they have about you is that you're not as interpersonally influential. or the perception they have about you is that you're not a team player, that you're not as good in teams. And so they would go into these situations and they would get asked the normal sorts of questions that we get asked, things like, you know, tell me about a time when, you know, and they would respond by telling about a time, for example, where they fought for resources for their team and they were interpersonally influential, where they didn't stop until they got that, until they closed that deal. And what I found then was that not only were they would hire on things like interpersonal influence, they were also rated higher in terms of things like communication. And they were more likely to get promoted, more likely to get that raise, more likely to get the financing, all based on addressing and flipping that sort of negative perception that they had about them in their favor. I'll give one sort of other quick example of this. In some of my research on ageism, we tend to assume that people who are older employees, that the lay perception is things like they're not as good at technology, they're not as technological proficient, things like that. But I found that there's an underlying perception, and that underlying perception boils down to one thing, and that's curiosity. That they think that older employees are not as curious. So when I then send those older employees into a job interview, for example, and I say, the perception they have about you is that they're not as curious. So they go in and they start asking questions and they start giving responses to those interviewers. They say things like, you know, I'm curious about how your vision has evolved over time, or I'm curious about your strategy, or I'm curious about your competitors. They're not only rated higher in terms of curiosity, they're rated higher in terms of logical proficiency, in terms of a whole host of other things, and they're more likely then to get that job. And so that's what I mean by sort of guiding and redirecting those sort of perceptions. When you're able to understand those underlying beliefs and attributions that others have of you, and that's a whole nother sort of segment of my book that I talk about, how do you hone your ability to kind of see those underlying perceptions? But when you're able to do that, that's when you're able to guide and redirect and really flip things in your favor. So I know that's a longer answer than I normally would give to a quantitative question, but sort of in the spirit of this sort of talk and interactional thing, that was great, Kendall. Thank you for kicking us off with that question and that observation. Lots of other hands that I see now, so this is great. Nicole, can we go to you next?
Yes. Hi, thank you so much.
Hi.
Great. This is awesome. My question is about whether you think there are specific mindsets that allow people to better utilize like the edge approach. And so how we can start to cultivate that within ourselves and like daily ways that we can try and like practice that, like incorporating this.
Absolutely. Okay, so that's great. So number one, there is a quiz on my website. If you go to my website, laurahuang.net, there's a quiz that you can take that speaks exactly to that. So it's called the Edge Quotient or the Edge Quiz, that based on my research I've taken questions that you can answer that then tell you like how equipped are you to sort of find your edge? Which dimension, which areas maybe do you need to be honing sort of more? And then I also have a practical guide, which has strategies and different ways that you can sort of figure out for yourself how to do this. I'll give you one example of a strategy that, or a tactic or sort of a how-to that you can sort of hone when I talk about honing this and thinking about this. So there's an exercise that I used to do with my students. I used to do a number of sort of experiential exercises with them to sort of hone this ability to develop their own gut feel or develop their way of understanding how others see them and how the attributions and the perceptions that others are making about them. But this particular, one example of this is called the 10 no's exercise. And what I would have my students do is over the course of a week, their assignment was to get 10 people to say no to them, okay? And they could do it over any sort of medium, over email, in person, you know, over the phone, but it had to be a no. It couldn't be a hedge. It couldn't be like, oh, well, I'll do this instead. If you get that, you have to start all over. And they had to record, they had to write one paragraph about each of the 10 no's, each of these no's that they got. And then in class the next week, they had to present one of these no's. So what this did was it emphasized and it showed students in this very real way that we are so used to getting people to say yes to us. We are so used to, like, the muscle we've been developing our entire lives is trying to influence people and trying to get people to like us, to say yes to us, to agree with us. But when the assignment, in order to complete this assignment, they had to get people to say no to them. They started realizing that they communicate with different people in different ways. They show people different sides of themselves. They show different dimensions of themselves to different people. And when they need to try to get to a no instead of a yes, they're realizing that they then start to communicate in different ways, using different language, and it starts to build this new way of understanding how other people see them. They realize, number one, that people are a lot less willing to say no to you than you think. Like, people also are much more willing to say yes than you think. It also shows you the way in which you communicate to different people and the reactions that different people have to you in different ways. You know, I say sometimes to some of my students, especially my recently students that were sort of having trouble getting into class, having trouble raising their hands and getting into the conversation and trying to hone this. I had a couple of students that I would say this to. I didn't say this to all of my students because that would just get all totally out of control. But the students who came to me and then said, like, I'm really having trouble, like, communicating in class and knowing how others react to my comment and whether a comment is a good one or not, I would say, you know what? This week, what I want you to do is just give something factual. When you raise your hand, communicate something factual, a case fact or something that adds to this discussion in a factual way. And see what the observation, see how people respond, see how your professor responds, see what other students say in response. And then next week, what I want you to do is I want you to listen to what other people are saying. And I want you to agree with what somebody is saying, but add one dimension that we haven't considered. And see what the reaction is in different classes, in different topics, different parts of this sort of, and then the week after that, I want you to agree with what they're saying, but then add one dimension that we haven't considered that maybe disagrees or has some sort of different nuance. And what you're really doing is you're sort of A-B testing for yourself the different reactions, the different perceptions, the different attributions that others have of you. And so when you do exercises like the 10 no's exercise, or you do something like this, it helps you sort of learn about those perceptions that others are having. It helps you learn about how you should react and the ways in which you're reacting that might be more positively inclined, more negatively inclined. And all of this starts to sort of hone your ability to do this. And Nicole, the other thing I want to sort of say to this is, the other thing I write about in the book is that everyone can learn how to do this, but not everyone is willing to. And what I mean by this is not everyone is willing to put themselves out there and fail in this way. Get those no's, get those 10 no's, be okay with that. Put yourself out there and allow yourself to be embarrassed. People are a lot more willing to have failure sometimes than they are to be embarrassed. Like, we get embarrassed and then we say, never again will I put myself in that situation. Well, when you feel embarrassed, there's so much data in that. There's so much data in why you should be doubling down and putting yourself in another situation where you're embarrassed in that same way or embarrassed in a different way, but similar. There's so much information in why was that? Why does that still continue to nag at me? Why does that still continue to bother me when it wouldn't in some other circumstance, or why someone else wouldn't be? When you sort of start to get those, that's when you start to hone those sort of things. And so in the book, I talk about lots of different practical exercises and different ways to sort of think about that. So thank you for that question. I'm going to let you lead this because now there's so many in the chat room. Okay. And also Gwen has her hands up. So I'm going to let you start calling on people so that that this is done in a more organized fashion than what I'm able to do.
Great. Well, why don't we go to Gwen and let us know what's your question?
Well, it's kind of unfair because I I did put my question at the bottom of the list, and a lot of people are ahead of me, but I'll just say it. And
that's
people-
okay. You can double dip, Gwen. If you do, okay. If you raise your hand and you write your question, there you go. You've already found your way to
well
get
done.
Okay. So my edge, yeah, but it is on all of our behalf. My question was, how can we use edge thinking to get a woman elected president?
Okay, so there's so many different components. There's so many different ways that I can answer this. So the question is, you know, how do we use this to get a woman elected president? Okay, so I've done a lot of research that's looked at gender and has looked at perceptions and attributions, and you know, the thing about gender, there's a large tradition of research. There's decades and decades of research that has looked at how this trade-off between warmth and competence, right? That we have these stereotypical, we have these gender-typed stereotypes that we expect certain people to act a certain way, behave in certain ways. And so I think what happens a lot of times is that when there's not a congruence between these male-typed and female-typed stereotypes and what we're seeing, that congruence really leads to some of these outcomes. So let me be more specific, because I'm being kind of abstract in this case. In some of my research, I find that when we think about, when we picture what an entrepreneur looks like, when we close our eyes and we have people try and picture an entrepreneur, we picture some dude in a garage. You know, technically, you know, people who are doing tech-based startups, maybe he is a college dropout from Stanford, but is a coder. We have these like views of what a successful prototype of an entrepreneur looks like. When we then have women pitching a technical startup that's high growth, high scale, it just doesn't fit. And so there's a number of things that happens there when there's this lack of congruence. Number one is that we start asking that female entrepreneur lots of questions in order to sort of test their credibility or test their legitimacy, test their technical competence. We also have expectations around how warm and competent that person should be. I found in some of my research, for example, we're more likely to ask women what are called prevention-focused questions, questions around competition, technical details, in order to try and figure out whether that person can fit this stereotype or fit this sort of this prototypical entrepreneur. We're more likely, on the other hand, to ask men what are called promotion focused questions, questions about the opportunity, how big something can get, the vision. And so part of this edge thinking is around acknowledging that this is a reality, that there are sort of stereotypes, and that we're going to be led by some of these stereotypes and be influenced by these stereotypes, but then also knowing how we can then turn that around to create a different sort of norm, a different way of sort of thinking. So there's one chapter in my book where I literally insult everyone. I mean, if you are not insulted, then I haven't done my job. I go through the stereotypes of every single person, of women, people of color, people who are old, people who are female and person and a person of color and old, like all of the different intersectionality, all of the different sort of countries, races, religions, classes, what those sort of stereotypes are. And what we need to do is acknowledge that 80% of those perceptions that others have about us are going to be based on those stereotypes. But then there's that 20% that we can sort of flip in our favor. And so this sort of edge thinking is about redirecting that, redirecting in a way where we can still be congruent with what those expectations are, but then exceed those expectations in other ways. And so the example I gave of entrepreneurs who are tech focused, what I had was when I had them pitch the same exact company, but then had them acknowledge the fact that startup investors are looking for the you know, understanding why this woman would be doing this, when they would add in one sentence even around, you know, and I'm doing this for the good of the world, or I'm doing this because I care about, you know, it all of a sudden, it gave the investors like, oh, they're doing this for this reason. And that created this congruence. It was this warmth or this social or communal aspect that they're like, okay, this now makes sense, right? And another sort of just really quick anecdote from my personal life is, you know, a lot of my research, again, I have for a really long time been doing research on angel investors and venture capitalists. And really early in my career, I would be interviewing these angel investors and venture capitalists and would walk into their office and they would say things to me like, oh, are you here to sell me Girl Scout cookies? Or, oh, like, you know, and I'll never forget, there was this one time where I walked in and there was this, this person had assigned an autographed basketball. And for whatever bizarre reason, I know I have tons of statistics memorized about the New York Knicks and the New York Yankees. Sorry to all of you from Boston. Started saying something or like commenting on these autographed baseballs and basketballs that they had and talking about like, you know, different players. And he looked at me and he was like I was sort of faking it or I was trying to, you know, that it didn't make sense that this woman would know things about sports. And I realized this, and immediately I sort of said, oh, you know, like, oh, I was an engineer by training, and I, like, know all these random statistics, and sort of, and then he was like, oh, it made sense. Asian, who was an engineering major, who knows lots about, and that was sort of that piece that, like, sort of delighted him. And then we started this big conversation, and to this day, you know, he's one of my mentors, these people that I go to, for advice, because he turned out, it was just that initial sort of reaction that didn't make sense to him. There was no malice in it. But that was sort of what was needed. So, hope that answers your question, Gwen.
I did the opposite and went to the top of the early ones. And there's several that kind of all come together. When people are asking, how do you keep all of these things top of mind? I mean, like, if you think about, you're in the middle of a pitch and you've got all the statistics and all the things that you're trying to be making sure that you have lined up, and then you've got to remember, oh, I've got the perception and I have to think about this. Like, how do you pull all of that together?
You don't try and keep all of these in your mind. This is the thing. We tend to over-prepare all the time. I mean, it's great to be prepared, but we over-prepare. And what happens is we go into meetings sometimes, right? Especially when we feel like the odds are against us or when we feel like somebody disagrees with us and we need to convince them. We often we do things like we have our six bullet points of ways in which as soon as we give those, they're like such great points. We're going to make this point. And then that counterpart, that other person is going to be like, yeah, you know what? You're totally right. I agree with you now. That never happens, right? But what happens is we have those six bullet points in our mind and we go in and we go on super strong presenting all of these different points. When that's the worst thing that we should be doing. Instead, we should have some sort of like maybe two or three vague notions of the titles rather than all of the subtitles, you know, of the, you know, these large sort of things. Because when we have those points in, we become rigid. We start to have those conversations and are completely always trying to redirect it to these amazing points that we have. Instead of going in and sort of having this more loose way so that we can sort of improvise and delight in the situation that we're in. We want to be able to sort of meet people where we are and sort of toggle and improvise and do all of these sorts of things. We need to be able to also tailor it to who we are and the opportunities that we sort of see. So like, I'll give you an example of this is, you know, when I first started, when I started my first faculty position, not at HBS, but at the Wharton School, one of my colleagues said, you know, you need to network. Like, you need to meet senior faculty. You need to meet all of the associate deans. And I was like, how do I do that, right? I was like this brand new faculty member. And I was like, how do I do that? And they said, well, obviously, you just invite them to dinner, invite them to lunch, like have meals with them, have drinks with them. And you know, you don't even need to have sort of an agenda You just want to get to know them, right? And so this was like the advice that I was given. And so I started emailing people, and I knew enough to know that I couldn't invite them to dinner or to drinks. Like that would just be, I knew enough that wasn't going to work for me, but I would instead was like, okay, like let me invite them to lunch. And so I was having lunch, a couple of weeks later with this senior associate dean. And he was like, okay, so what do you want to talk about? And I was like, oh, I don't have an agenda. I just wanted to get to know you. And all of a sudden he looked really like almost annoyed, because here's a super, like this person doesn't have a lot of time. And he figured if I'm going to be inviting him to lunch, there should be a reason for that. There should be some big thing I wanted to talk to him about, like the state of the university, or like our annual fund, or like how curriculum is going to be changed. Like, and where's the agenda, right? For my male colleagues, it was totally fine to be like, hey, let's go out to drinks and get to know each other. For me, that wasn't going to work. And so the lunch was disastrous, right? It was, I made such a horrible impression on him. And I was like, thinking, I'm never going to do that again. And then a couple weeks later, I was on a flight. And I was giving a talk at this conference. And this senior associate dean was on the same flight as me. And I saw him and I was like, oh my gosh, please hide, because I don't think I can ever have a conversation with this man again. And he saw me, and at the end of the flight, he was like, oh, hey, hi, do you remember me? And I'm like, oh yeah, of course I remember you. And he's like, are you going to this conference? And it turns out he was going to the same conference that I was going to. And he said, so how are you getting to the conference hotel, which was about 45 minutes away from this airport? And I said, oh, I don't know, I'm probably gonna get a taxi or something. He's like, oh, well, I have my private car waiting. Do you want to ride? And I was like, oh, well, I've got my private car as well, which is a private taxi cab. But he's like, no, come join me and so over the course of, I joined him, and in this 45 minute ride from the airport to the hotel, it was no longer on somebody in someone else's way. I had an opportunity to get to know him where there didn't need to be an agenda, there were no sort of expectations. And we were able to just sort of talk and chat, and he got to know me. And this is, again, like one of the people who has remained in my life as someone that I go to, that is really influential, and I've been able to maintain a connection with for a really long time. What we don't realize is that when we say, how do we keep all of this at the top of our mind? That what we sometimes are asking for is this recipe, or this like, what are the five things that I need to do to get my edge? Like so many people are like, what are the five steps that I need to take to get an advantage or to gain my edge? I wish there were these five steps that I could tell you. It's really very, very personal. And the more personal you make it, the more authentic it's going to be, and the more useful it's going to be. When you see somebody who is in some sort of position that you want to be, a CEO of a company or something, you say, how did you get to that position? And they say, oh, well, first I went to business school, then I did a rotation in sales, and then I did this. I can guarantee you, if you follow that exact same path, you will not get to that exact same position, because you're a different person. And you have a different set of skills and attributes. So the best that I can sort of present is this framework for thinking about, how do you enrich and delight and guide, and how does your effort go further for you? But really, it's not about keeping these in your mind. And if I can sort of say one other thing around this is, and then I promise we'll get to more of these, but it's that a lot of times we also give this advice to people. We say, just be yourself, right? Like, be yourself. People ask you for advice even. They're like, oh, I'm going to interview for this position. And we tell them, just be yourself. Or I'm giving this big presentation. Oh, they're going to love you. Just be yourself. Or you're going on a date with somebody. Oh, just be yourself. That is actually horrible advice. Be yourself is horrible advice, and not for the reasons why you think I'm going to say. It's horrible advice because there is no yourself. There are yourselves. There are so many different versions of who you are. We are complicated and varied people. And when you say be yourself, that doesn't really provide us with any sort of information. I often talk about it like each individual, we are like, if you think about each person as a diamond, as a solitary diamond, and based on that diamond, you're going to shine differently based on the lighting, the environmental conditions, based on the cuts of the diamond, based on the angles at which you're looking at, based on who is looking at it, right? Like, based on that, you can turn that diamond, it's gonna shine brightly and shine less brightly. Like, we are a diamond with flaws and facets and different cuts. And when you go and you're interacting with somebody, what you're really doing is what you wanna be doing is showing that angle of your diamond that's gonna shine the brightest. That's when you're gonna be able to have that richest, deepest connection with someone. This is not strategic. This is not managing impressions. This is showing them that side of you that is going to shine the brightest so that you can have that connection and you can continue to sort of delight them and guide them and show them how you enrich.
Yeah. Laura, you know, I noticed that this is your first book, but it's certainly not your first publication. So could you just talk to us a little bit about, you know, like moving away from the content a little bit and talking about the process, like how is writing a book for a more general practitioner audience different than your other forms of publication? Then I'll ask you, did you like one better than the other?
Yeah, I mean, it was this whole process actually has been terrifying. It really has, and I'll tell you why it's been terrifying. I had been doing research for a really long time. And when my research is sort of out there, it's like numbers and statistics and findings, and it's like aggregate findings. And so when I started getting asked the question, like, well, what do we do about this? What do we sort of, I had never really intended to write a book. Research is sort of the thing that I've been doing. But I kept getting asked this question, like, what do we do about all of these disparities that we're seeing? What do we do about the disadvantages? What do we do about the fact that we are working hard and not always getting the benefits of that or seeing the success behind that? And what I recognized was that a lot of the academic findings, a lot of the research was around these structural things that we can do, right? Things like we need more women mentors, or we need more women who are in executive positions, for example. And all of that is great. None of that is going to hurt. But at the same time, it doesn't help us as an individual to empower ourselves as we're either waiting for the system to change, or the system may change in ways that we don't intend, creating other issues, or maybe they're gonna change, but more slowly or in different ways than we expected. And so I really wanted to write a book that was around how we individually could empower ourselves, even within a system that is either imperfect or imperfect and not changing, that even as it's changing, that we don't need to wait around for it to change, that there's things that we can do ourselves. But in order to do that, it did have to be very personal. And so when I was writing the book, the first draft, right, was really around, I just was trying to get 80,000 words down, to be honest. I was just trying to get 80,000 words down on paper. And so when I did that, I sent it to the publisher, figuring that there would be a really long editing process, that we would edit this. And there was. We went through this 3 to 4 month process sort of editing it. But when I finally got the final manuscript back and was reading it, it was like the first time I was reading it from a true reader rather than a writer's perspective. And as I was reading it, I was like, oh my gosh, this story is still in there. Like, that didn't get edited out, or this didn't get, and it was a lot of sort of, so that's what I mean by terrifying. It was all these really personal things where it felt like people were going to be reading things that were much more, made me feel much more vulnerable than my research has ever made me feel. It's stories, I also, very purposely in the book, there's some examples there of really well-known people that we know, like Elon Musk and Steve Jobs, But I would say 80 to 90% of the stories and the examples I tell in the book are of people who are not well known at all. They're everyday people. Because not that super famous and well-known people haven't had to face adversity, but I really wanted to tell the stories of people who are ordinary people who are facing ordinary everyday adversity and in lots of different ways and how they've had to overcome it. And in doing so, there's just stories about people that I know, people that I've interviewed, people that I've become very close with. And so that's why it felt very terrifying.
Yeah. But there's a question I think that follows on with the personal aspect and the having the stereotypes is, Addis asks, how much does culture play into the edge approach? Because you've spent a lot of time looking at culture and ethnicity.
Yeah, it plays a ton. I mean, this is that piece around in order to know the perceptions that others have about you, that you have to understand what's happening culturally, what industry and the people, like there's this whole backdrop for these perceptions and attributions that are being made about you, right? You know, I'll give you an example of, so for example, Ronan Farrow is one person that I've talked to about adversity and advantage. And Ronan Farrow, who is the epitome of cis white male privilege, right? He comes from his mother is Mia Farrow. He's incredibly wealthy. He's Caucasian and attractive and well-spoken and well-educated. I mean, all of these sort of perceptions that we tend to think about. And he was telling me about how a lot of times he walks into rooms and he has no idea how people are perceiving him. Because at the same time that he has all of those sort of things happening, he knows that there's other things, dynamics, where people have said to him, like, you don't deserve your Pulitzer. You only have your Pulitzer because of those things. Or you're not even a good writer. You're only a good writer because of these sort of things. Right? We walk into different situations, and based on that mix of what we're seeing, based on, again, like the lighting, the environmental conditions, the people who are there, those perceptions are going to differ. In some situations, we might have an advantage. In other times, we don't. And so it's so important to understand how culture plays into this, in addition to all of these other dynamics.
Yeah. Wow. Well, there's a whole list of questions here. We could keep going and keep going, but we're very close to the end of our time, and I would be remiss if I didn't wrap up and keep people on time, because we know how difficult it is to sit in these Zoom meetings. So let me pull together the questions that we didn't get to, and hopefully we can continue a dialogue in some way, maybe with Working Knowledge, or with putting some things up on the Baker Library website. But you've given us a lot to think about. I think the questions around, you know, like, what's the concrete example? How can we really do this? Shows that people are indeed looking for a way to turn these adversities into advantage. So, but I wanted to, I don't know if you noticed that on the verso of the title page, so the back of the title page, the Library of Congress assigned what I think is a really interesting subject heading to your book. Have you ever looked at that?
I haven't. This is a surprise to me.
Well,
I'm a little bit scared as to what you're going to reveal, because I have to tell you that at one point, my book was number one on the Amazon bestsellers list for mate seeking.
Oh, mate.
So I was sort of like, what? I didn't write this book about mate seeking, but okay, there you have it. So I'm a little frightened as to what you're going to say the Library of Congress has assigned to this.
So one of the subject headings that they assigned is success. So if somebody is searching for success, they'll find are looking for books on that topic, they'll find yours. And I think that is emblematic of what this session was for us. So first of all, thank you for helping us bring Books at Baker online, because it is something we've been thinking about doing. And there's, like they said, don't waste a good crisis. Make sure that you get some of the things done that you've always wanted to do. So I think those clever librarians who assigned that knew what they were talking about. So thank you for our very first successful adventure online. I also wanted to thank Ashley Wheeler and Robin Pashas from Marketing Communication, because the two of them have helped us make it through this session flawlessly, or at least we hope everything was recorded, and we'll hope it all works out. And then Dina Gerdeman and Mariah Tumbleson Shaw from Baker have been just so helpful in making sure all the logistics. But most of all, we want to thank all of you for joining us. Our last Books at Baker is going to be in about a month's time with Hiro Takeuchi. And those people who have followed Hiro and Professor Nonaka's work in knowledge management will know that these guys are the two rock stars in this whole field. And what they have done is, if you take the information taxonomy from data, information, knowledge to wisdom, we always used to joke and say we're just stopping at knowledge management because there's no way we can get to wisdom. But the two of them have said that the long-term game, not just the short-term game that we are all focused on of innovation, the long-term game really requires the wisdom of our employees. So I think this is going to be just another fantastic conversation about how we innovate, how we keep thinking differently about our work, and how we keep moving towards success. So we're still working out the details of the session with Hiro, because he is at home in Tokyo, and needless to say, that's gonna be a little difficult for him to make it. So we'll see if we'll have another kind of Zoom session with him. So lots of us to work out there yet. If we don't have your email address and you'd like to sign up, just put it in the chat, and we'll make sure that we get the right time to you for next time. So Laura, again, thank you so much for sharing. We're really looking forward. If you haven't seen the book, let's see if my edge will do it. Here it is. It's available at Baker Library. It's available online. It's available, lots of information on your website. So thank you again for everything. And thanks everybody for joining us. We'll see you in about a month. Take care.